from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, I'll take a look at a new book about the Richmond Group of Artists.
I'll get a preview of the upcoming Art vs. Art and also a preview of the Art Squared events.
I'll find out about this weekend's Architects Home Tour, and there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Most Indiana art fans are aware of the Hoosier Group, that affiliation of painters most closely associated with Brown County. But Sean Dingworth, executive director of the Richmond Art Museum, wants the world to know about the extraordinary accomplishments of the Richmond Group artists. Sean has recently published a book by that name, and he came over from Richmond to tell Sharon Gamble about the Richmond Group artist book and a supporting exhibition.
So I want you to start with a quotation about Richmond and its art scene, because this just really puts it all in perspective.
Yeah, in 1910, John White Alexander, then the president of the National Academy, met with a reporter from the New York Times in 1910. He was asked what he thought about the prospect for American art. And he responded by saying, "Have you ever heard of Richmond, Indiana? Probably not. All artists have. They put on one of the best exhibitions in the country. I wish New York could compare with it."
Wow. That's just astonishing.
Yeah, it's remarkable, and it really puts in context as to what was occurring in Richmond and Indiana in terms of their promotion and support of American artists.
And that it gives us, in addition to some pride, you know, some additional pride, it gives an interesting perspective on the fact that at the time period we're talking about, we were, even though we'd been a country for rather a long time, we didn't have a native art scene yet. We didn't have a native is probably the wrong word, but we didn't have a unique identity yet. We were in the middle of developing that.
Correct. And, you know, during this time period, during the Industrial Revolution, Americans were assimilating European lifestyle. And so they were more interested in works abroad, collecting European works. And American art was relatively new. And so what we had happening in Richmond was an opportunity for these young American artists to send their work to be seen, and not only to be exhibited, but they were being purchased by citizens of the area. And so it really became a very popular exhibition. In those early days, as many as 10,000 people would come to those exhibitions.
Wow. I want to get back to the Richmond Group of Artists and the exhibitions, but you can't really talk much about the history of Richmond without talking about Quaker roots.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us who don't know, tell us a little bit about the place of the arts, or visual art in particular, in Quaker life.
Sure. Well, you know, typically the arts were not something that were promoted within the Quaker community. However, something a little different was occurring in Richmond. And, you know, most of the Richmond Group artists were Quakers themselves. The leaders of the Art Association of Richmond were also Quakers. They did not discourage the arts, but yet they were encouraging the arts. And that was something a little different than what had happened previously throughout other Quaker communities in the United States.
You know, I was fascinated by the idea that a lot of shops would have paintings by mm-hmm. these artists, partly why? Out of pride or to promote them? Or
yeah, I think it was pride. I think one of the things I talk about is that there was certainly within the community this desire for culture, mm-hmm. And an appreciation for it. And, of course, you know, building the Art Association, which is now the Richmond Art Museum, was one of those things they did. But the other thing they did was they actively displayed the works of the Richmond Group artists within their businesses, whether it was, you know, an art or paint supply store.
Or a dry goods store.
Or a dry goods store. Yeah. That's correct. And very popular within the community.
So who are some of the top two or three people who kind of had the vision to say, let's do this? This is, we've got talent and we've got beautiful scenes to paint.
Sure. You know, with, you know, one of the things we certainly have to mention is the establishment of Earlham College and the fact that they brought John Elwood Bundy to Richmond to teach art, and he was sort of considered the dean of the group. But within the community, there were other leaders such as William Dudley Folk, who was the president of the Art Association for over 25 years. He was in the Roosevelt administration. He was a lawyer. He had an incredible personal art collection. And so he was a real champion for the arts. The other would be our first director, Ella Bond Johnston. I'm only our sixth director in our 116-year history. And
oh,
that's,
my gosh.
That's because she was there for 50 years.
Wow.
and she was really a formidable force in American art and gave lectures all around the country about American art. And so these people really championed the cause of the Richmond Group and art.
And some of these artists found patronage among the local merchants, too, like Star Piano Surface and Price Confectioners, not only maybe displayed works, but helped put money up for exhibitions.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of them were personal collectors and, you know, wanted to share that with the Richmond residents. And, of course, we have to mention the fact that we would not have had an art colony if the artists didn't have day jobs. And many of these artists were working in the factories in the Whitewater Gorge in Richmond. So many of those people who owned those industries or owned the businesses like Star Jeanette were able to help support their income through exhibiting their works.
I love the picture you evoke of a couple of these painters were sign painters. You know, that's what they paid the bills with. And there were pieces of farm equipment that were decorated with signs with the name of the company that
sure.
made the equipment.
Sure. The term they were called in the day was interior decorators, mm-hmm. Which today we conjure up a different meaning for that. But essentially, these were skilled tradespeople who were painting the pinstriping on the farm machinery equipment. We do know of some examples that exist where they even painted landscape scenes on the lids of the Hoosier Drill farm machinery.
Wow.
But, of course, the lettering. And again, and a lot of their friendships began because they knew each other working with in the factories.
Let's go back to Bundy for a second. He had a particular relationship with the landscape of Indiana.
Yeah, he you know, he's sort of known as the painter of trees. He loved the interior woodland. Of course, we know Indiana has a beautiful landscape, and he did. He loved hiking into the woods and setting up his easel, painting plein air. It's told that he painted one particular tree over 40 times.
Oh, my gosh. And probably across the years, the tree looked a little new each time.
Absolutely, yeah. And different seasons of the year as well.
Yeah. So the Richmond Group predates the Hoosier Group a little bit?
Yeah. You know, I think that was one of the interesting discoveries through my research was that they really began in 1870, which is about a decade before T.C. Steele and John Otis Adams left for Munich to study. So about 40 years before the Brown County movement.
You have deep roots in Richmond and a lot of contacts, which I think helped you in your research for this book. And do I remember that you discovered three previously unknown paintings in the process of your research?
Yeah. You know, one of the great stories is one of the things I was particularly interested in getting back to the Quaker roots was there was involvement by women in this group, which we're certainly very proud of. And one of the earliest painters who had studied from Bundy was Mary Hodgen Lebo. And I had read about her, researched about her, but we had never seen an artwork by her. So in going through some research, I recognized a local Richmond name. And by chance, I just picked up the phone and called this gentleman, told him what I was working on, the project, and I said, by any chance, would you have any information? Well, it ended up this was his grandmother.
No.
And he had said in all the years of living in Richmond, no one had ever asked him. But it ended up that the family, the entire family, owns works by her, and none of them had been previously exhibited or shown. So that was a really great discovery.
Wow. I mean, that's like a once-in-a-career experience.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and that's the other thing. There were some other group, members of the group of which we were unable to find works. And I hope with this publication, as people read it, that maybe more of these kinds of things will come forward.
Sure. And don't worry, we're going to tell you how to find a copy of this for yourself. You have an exhibition coming up because people who read this, like, as I did, and I'm, you know, it's one thing to look at beautiful reproductions of paintings, but there's still only two dimensions, and it's lovely to be able to go actually be
correct.
In a room with the paintings.
Nothing like seeing it in person. Yes, we have 50 of the paintings, which are illustrated in the book, on display now at the Richmond Art Museum. That will be up through October 3rd. And then the exhibition is going to travel to Indianapolis. It'll be at the Indiana State Museum from February through May.
Hmm. For anybody who hasn't had the experience of going to the Richmond Art Museum, explain your physical plant.
Sure. What we say is, you know, to our knowledge, we are the only public art museum housed within an active public high school in the United States. So we are part of the Richmond Community School campus. We have the building on the north wing of the school. All the high school art classrooms are located directly behind us. We have four galleries, three of which are for temporary exhibitions. One is for our permanent collection. And we also have a 500-seat auditorium. The current building we're in is a WPA building. It was actually paid for by one of those local industrialists to permanently house the Richmond Art Museum.
And it's beautiful.
It's a beautiful building.
Neoclassical, just gorgeous. I mean, it looks more like walking into a museum than a school.
I agree, yeah.
And how did it happen that the museum came to be in a school?
Sure, it was those early exhibitions of which we spoke about earlier. You know, initially when the community desired to have an art exhibition, they decided that the public school system would be a great place to have an exhibition, that people in the community would know how to get there. So in the early days, those exhibitions were held in June, right after school was let out. They would whisk away the desk, they would put up fabric, they would bring in flowers and palm trees, and they would hang the art. In those early days, they borrowed art from local residents as well as displayed the works of the Richmond group. But as it progressed, that's when they started soliciting American artists from Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Boston, to send their works. So as the popularity of this grew and the school was looking to build a new building in 1910, they decided to give a permanent space to the Art Association. So it was housed on the third floor. And then again, when the school needed to expand and build the current building in the late 30s, again, we were given a designated space. And that this particular building we're in now was actually dedicated on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, 1941.
Sharon Gamble with Sean Dingworth, Executive Director of the Richmond Art Museum and author of the new book, The Richmond Group Artists. You can learn more about the book and the exhibition that illustrates it at richmondartmuseum.org. Again, richmondartmuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Next weekend is the main event for Primary Colors Art versus Art competition. Travis DiNicola spoke with Primary Colors President Brian Short and artist Martin Kuntz about the event and about Martin's upcoming show.
Brian, Martin, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
You guys got a lot coming up in the next couple weeks. Let's start with Art versus Art, the incredible art competition where art is destroyed and saved. It's a fun event. It's a great event. Brian, tell me a bit about it because it's coming up this weekend.
Art versus Art is a winner-take-all painting competition where paintings face off head-to-head on stage. At that point, there is a wheel of death. At that point,
the wheel of death. Sorry, I have to use that voice when we talk about art versus art.
It demands it. So what happens is the paintings go head-to-head on stage, and based on a crowd appreciation, we get a winner. That winner goes on to the next round. The loser faces, again, the wheel of death.
And death can, I know it changes up every year, but there have been chainsaws, there have been, we'll just say splattered paint, knives, swords.
Sure. We always like to keep the new modes of death a little bit of a secret until the show.
I understand.
As always, the chainsaw will be there.
Oh, good. Okay.
Something new this year, we're going to retire one of the modes of death that have been around for about 10 years now. So it's a little special. It's a big secret. You'll have to find out at the event.
Nice. And again, this is at the Vogue, Friday, September 26th. The painting competition's already taken place in terms of the artists making the pieces.
Correct.
All the artists obviously know that their work could be bought or it could be subject to death. And they go into that knowing that.
Correct. Yes, they sign a contract saying, I'm very well aware what could happen. Now, one of the things that's very nice about the competition is of that money the painting goes for on stage, or even the ones that don't make it in the top 16, the artist gets 70% of whatever we sell that painting for.
That's great.
So we try to keep the artist going. You know, hey, if you get that money, it's going to help maybe make a couple more paintings.
And that's what Primary Colors does. I mean, you guys put on a lot of very fun events, but in the end, you're all about supporting local artists.
Correct.
And
yep.
In fact, I was just looking at the online voting is going on now for people to pick the finalists and stuff. There's a lot of fun stuff there this year on people made for Art versus Art.
It's always interesting. You know, every year it seems like the crop gets a little bit better and a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And subject matter is there's no rules. So I think you have people that aren't traditionally artists and they come out and they just paint what they feel.
Yeah. And they're having fun. And some of the stuff's cartoony. Some of the stuff's very, you know, well crafted and kind of everything in between. You definitely get a sense that some of the artists are trying to create work of subject matter that will appeal to the crowd.
There is definitely a popularity in the graphic design oriented paintings for sure. Pop culture definitely plays a big part in how paintings advance.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, it's a great competition. I love going to it. I've always had a lot of fun at it. And again, it is a fundraiser in part for Primary Colors.
Absolutely. It's one of our largest fundraisers of the year.
Yeah. And in addition to doing Art versus Art and a whole bunch of other things, you guys also have, of course, the Primary Colors Gallery down in Fountain Square, where Martin is going to be showing in October. Tell me a bit about that, buddy.
Yeah, I have a big show coming up. It'll be my first solo show in 2 years.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, the title of the show is Monkeys with Guns.
Love the title.
Thank you. Yeah, it actually alludes to a Tom Waits quote that sort of sums up the body of work, which I should probably grab that in front of me. But I don't have it in front of me.
That's all right. But your work, I mean, very sort of, it's got a very pop feel to it, very graphic heavy, a lot of fun stuff. And these are big paintings you're doing this time, right?
Yeah, for the most part, I tried to kind of tone it down a little bit, which didn't really work. They're still probably in the realm of, 3 feet by 5 feet, 4 feet by six.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple maybe that are, 2x3. But for the most part, yeah, they're pretty large, loud, colorful, very similar to my last body of work as far as aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you've got, in addition to, you've got the opening on October 3rd, but you're also doing closing reception, artist talk, and don't forget the Halloween dance party.
Exactly.
All on Halloween.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think the work kind of fits along with the idea of it's fun, it's colorful, and there are a lot of images actually derived from horror movies, along with other pop culture references. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to the artist talk. I think they're a really great way for artists to engage with the community and for those peers and interested patrons to get a chance to ask the artists questions and to better understand sort of the decision-making and art-making process.
For those people who may not be entirely familiar with all the galleries down Fountain Square, what's the best way to get to the Primary Colors Gallery?
If you know the back entrance by Red Lion Grog House, there's a staircase right there, and it's just pretty much up the stairs.
Of the Murphy building there, yes. And then second floor.
Yeah, it's suite 217.
And to be clear, Martin, none of your work is going to be destroyed in Art versus Art.
No,
there's no crossover here.
Not allowed.
That would be a conflict of interest. Yeah, we might actually do some board member paintings this year to have them destroyed just to better demonstrate.
That'd be kind of fun.
We've had a lot of paintings sold in the past, and I think the crowd needs a little bit more destruction. So,
I'm going to ask you both, what's your from the past, because I don't want you to give away what's coming up this year, but from the past, what has been your favorite mode of destruction? Martin?
The chainsaw is pretty classic. The sound backstage of it getting fired up. You pretty much know what's going to happen, and it really never fails.
So. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. How about you, Brian?
I would have to say, what did we have? We had the heart on last year.
That was a good
where
one.
We had the Jell-O heart that they pulled out of. They cut a hole in the painting and they pulled it out. But the best part about it was it didn't work perfectly, and there was sawdust from the chainsaw on the heart, so they couldn't eat the Jell-O heart. So they were all like, "Oh, what do we do?" So it's sometimes when they don't work perfectly, that's
even more fun.
Yeah.
So the crowd at Art versus Art, I mean, they really get into it.
Bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
They are a bit bloodthirsty, but they have a great time. It's a really cool way to, you know, I think, I mean, just, you know, make an art event a completely different type of competitive, fun, bloodthirsty type of night.
I think we make it so anybody can participate, and absolutely anybody can come have fun, watch them get destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. Good. And promote some great local artists and give other people a chance to make some art as well.
Exactly.
Very cool. Guys, it's always great to see you both. Primary Colors is doing great work. Can't wait for Art versus Art. And also, Martin, for your show, again, the title, Monkeys with Guns.
That's correct. Yep.
Travis DiNicola with Primary Colors, President Brian Short, and artist Martin Kuntz. The Art versus Art main event takes place at the Vogue on Friday, September 26th. Martin's show, Monkeys with Guns, will open at Primary Gallery in Fountain Square on October 3rd, and will have a closing reception, artist talk, and Halloween dance party on Halloween. You can get more information about both at primarycolors.org, and that's primary, colours.org. Art Squared is again taking place this Saturday, September 20th, in Fountain Square, and includes One Love Playing for Change, providing live entertainment for the day. Travis DiNicola spoke with event organizers Kelly Mergot and Phil Christopher.
Kelly, Phil, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you guys.
Good to see you, Travis.
Thank you, Travis.
Absolutely. And so we've got Art Squared this weekend, Saturday, in Fountain Square, with about 100 different arts events, it seems, going on simultaneously, or at least three or four. Kelly,
but this is the one that's important,
this
right?
is the important one. This is really cool. There's so much. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of stuff going on even within Art Squared. That's mm-hmm. what I mean. I mean, you've got Masterpiece, mm-hmm. you've got Playing for Change, you've got all types of stuff going on all day. Tell me a bit about this.
So this is the fourth annual Art Squared, where we do bring the art fair, Masterpiece in a Day, and the parade all
to the
neighborhood.
Right.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Parade.
Who can
Can't forget
parade?
The parade.
So this is the fourth year we've done that as a combined event under the name Art Squared. So it starts at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And our slogan is Make Art, Buy Art, and Be Art. So the Make Art is the the Masterpiece in a Day competition. We have a visual arts and writing category. Mm-hmm. We've actually added poetry to our writing category this year. And as you know, when it comes to not-for-profits and all-volunteer organizations, what we're really trying to do is develop partnerships that sort of elevate our event. So we're really excited that this year our writers' works, the selected entries, will be published.
Excellent.
So we are going to have them published on, it's the creative product of Well Done Marketing. It's mm-hmm. Punchnell's online magazine.
Sure. Right. They have a great online site, and Well Done's, of course, located down Fountain Square.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then we're also, for our visual artists, their work will be published, but we're actually doing a lot this year to promote a big First Friday event in October. So the artists who are selected from the visual arts category, they will be on display for our First Friday show. Okay. And if they sell, then 50% of the proceeds will go to the artists and 50% go back to the Arts Council to help us for the next year.
And this is the Arts Council of Fountain Square.
Yes.
Fountain Square Arts Council.
Fountain Square Arts Council.
So let me ask you two things, two very important things. One, people can still register even through Saturday morning, right?
For you don't even have to register. You can just show up. You can show up at 9 a.m. at 924 Shelby Street. And you, the artist will have till 3 p.m. that day. So, and obviously with Masterpiece in a Day, the idea is that you create it in a day. So we ask that, you know, sort of that you be honest and you keep
You bring your own supplies.
Yes, you bring your own supplies.
But the idea is sort of do it on site.
Do it on site on day. I mean, obviously that neighborhood and the community, it's just a very motivating landscape anyway. So we hope that people come to the neighborhood and are inspired by the buildings, the neighborhood, the community, just even the day. We've had some really cool Masterpiece in a Day entries where it's actually a painting of the event. So.
Which makes perfect sense.
So
that's the one question.
So
Saturday morning, you know, artists, writers can still show up and do Masterpiece in a Day.
Yep.
Let's talk about the parade real quick.
Oh, please. Absolutely. So the parade is super fun.
Yes. And the parade is a huge arts parade.
It is a huge arts parade. We are actually doing that would be huge. $1,000 in cash prizes. We encourage everyone to sort of just come out. As long as you're family friendly, we're really not going to turn you away.
So you don't really even have to register for the parade.
You really don't. We'd like to have that happen, but I have to tell you, a lot of times people just show up that day.
Like making a float.
Yeah.
Well,
the Modus Dance Theater, which actually their home is in Fountain Square, they come out every year and they just do a performance along the route. So that's pretty cool.
Love Modus. Where does the route start and what time?
So that is at 920 Shelby. That's at the Southeast Community Service Center. And then it actually just goes through the main commercial area of Fountain Square.
Okay.
And then it ends up at the SECS again. Starts at 5 p.m.
The parade starts at 5. Okay.
Parade starts at 5. And I have to give a shout out too then, because you have all of these activities going on. And then our art fair. So we have 80 booths this year that we're super excited about. We keep growing. I also love that 100% of those are local.
That's very cool.
And we have 40% retention, too. So I don't think a lot of people realize that. And so you can come from 12 to 6 and just experience the neighborhood and buy some really great, unique, get kickstarted on your Christmas
shop.
All this is free.
Right?
Yes. Well, the art is not free.
Yes. Well, of course not. But
we got to keep the vendors coming back. So.
Yeah. And of course, while this is all going on, simultaneously, parallel to it, is the Play for Change, the One Love Play for Change. Phil, this was a huge event last year, and now you guys are making it happen again, and it's so cool that it's tied in with Art Squared. Tell me a bit about this.
We were very pleased, and it's interesting because Playing for Change Day started in 2011. We did our first one. And so we have the same we've been running this parallel thing with Art Squared for 4 years. Last year, Kelly got together with us, and we coordinated our activity and became the music producer for Art Squared, which was the most perfect fit because we want to be in front of lots of people. We're raising money, $1, $2, $5 at a time, for children's music education programs in impoverished parts of the world. This is what Playing for Change Foundation does.
Right, and this is an international foundation.
Yes, it's international. Mm-hmm. And in fact, on the September 20th, 4th Playing for Change Day, we will be the biggest. For the fourth year running, will be the biggest Playing for Change Day event of over 300 occurring simultaneously around the world.
That's so cool.
And our musicians will be donating their time. Some of the finest musicians in Central Indiana will be there. Our partnership with Art Squared is a dream come true for everyone because we have this atmosphere to offer. We have this uplifting music. We have these great musicians. This year we'll see again Jethro Easy Fields and Ben Brashear and members of the Punk and Holler Boys and just great bands playing. Megan Hopkins is coming and just great music. We have surf band will be back.
Oh, fun.
The surf band will be back. And all we really ask is that we be in a place where we can give this to people and ask them to give to the kids in places like West Africa, South Africa, Nepal, Thailand, the schools of Playing for Change supports.
And all the musicians, they're donating their time, their talents. They're going to be performing throughout the day, mainly in that sort of that one performance venue, kind of right by the fountain in
the
Fountain
Plaza.
Square,
the Plaza. Yeah, the newly
well, this year,
newly
yeah.
Plaza.
This year, mm-hmm. six locations.
Oh, well,
in Fountain
okay,
Square.
Cool.
We have so many great musicians that we've expanded. And because the Midway, the whole Art Squared Midway, you know, is a perfect place for our musicians are intermixed with the vendors, mm-hmm. with the artists. And it's all part of a while you're strolling down the Midway, you come upon our musicians there. We're going to have
that's great.
Six set locations, including the Plaza, which will have full bands,
mm-hmm.
Lots of acoustic musicians all over Fountain Square. And then we'll also have troubadours and strolling buskers. So it'll be
nice.
A little bit like a busking festival, too.
And if people want to make a donation to a Playing for Change that day, they'll be able to do
yes.
so.
Mm-hmm. They'll be able to make cash donations.
Mm-hmm.
We have many of us who perform have donated our CDs and things to be sold for donations. Mm-hmm. So you can get it. You can pick up a CD, drop a donation. There's ways that we can show you that you can donate online. Playing for Change Foundation, of course, is a 501c3 mm-hmm. not-for-profit, so you can make tax-deductible donations. Checks are fine, online donations. And then 100% of every dollar that we have ever collected going into 4 years and including all of our activities this summer, our work with Indie Fringe and things like that, 100% goes directly to Playing for Change Foundation.
That's so cool.
97 cents on a dollar that they collect goes directly to the schools. So it's an extremely vital charity.
Well, I love this because it's such a great combination of, I mean, Kelly, here you are, I mean, in many ways representing the local as you can get mm-hmm. with artists and events taking place in Fountain Square. And Phil, of course, I mean, we're talking about a lot of great local and regional musicians, but you're looking at an international cause. And what a cool partnership mm-hmm. to come together.
Absolutely.
In this.
Travis DiNicola with Art Squared's Kelly Mergot and Phil Christopher. Art Squared takes place this Saturday, the 20th, from noon to 6 p.m. in Fountain Square. More information is available at discoverfountainsquare.com. Discoverfountainsquare.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know, the weather's been trending this way, and guess what happens this very weekend?
Is it? Oh, it's officially fall, isn't it?
It's officially fall. The
well,
autumn
what do you
equinox.
Know?
Huh. I know.
There we go.
There we go. Say goodbye to summer. Although, don't worry, there'll still be some warm days ahead. And
that's
in fact,
right.
we have some outdoor activities on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do
for the new season.
The new season fall edition. Well, one thing I'm excited about this weekend is the opening of IRT's season. And they are, of course, opening with the Two Gentlemen of Verona. But on Sunday, September 21st, from 5 to 7 p.m., they are doing a Ruffs and Tails community event. The IRT is inviting dog owners to its first ever Ruffs and Tails, where owners and their special four-legged friends can meet fellow canines, chow on delicious treats, and take their picture in Shakespearean ruff, all while benefiting the Humane Society. This is taking place at the IRT. Why, you ask? Well, because...
they can?
Because they can.
Because it doesn't work for cats?
You could try to bring a cat, but that may be tricky. Two Gentlemen of Verona does feature their furry tail wagging cast member, Crab. And so, so you know, if your dogs are a big fan of Crab's acting and want to enjoy some special treats from Three Dog Bakery, then this would be a good time to do it. Yep, so there you go, and you can come see the show. Check out IRTLive.org for more information about Ruffs and Tails on Sunday.
I enjoyed your conversation with the IRT's Janet Allen and with painter Kyle Ragsdale last week.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes.
It's funny they didn't mention the dogs.
They didn't mention the dogs. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we were talking about the autumn equinox, which is this weekend, and you can celebrate it in the 100 Acres Nature Park at the IMA. On Saturday the 20th, this Saturday, from 3 to 7, there'll be sonic explorations, performances, and oral, A-U-R-A-L, experiments mm-hmm. during the autumn equinox. You can listen to a headphone concert, frolic in a sonic playground created by Beatrix Jarr, interact with sounds from the lake, and enjoy a guitar orchestra conducted by Indianapolis artist Stuart Hyatt. And, of course, you can stroll the grounds and watch things starting to change colors as fall comes in. And go inside, for that matter. If you're going to be at the IMA, you might as well go inside as well.
That's going to be a great way to celebrate
mm-hmm.
the equinox in mm-hmm. fall. Also, you know, and one other thing going on at the IMA that I want to mention, Bill Viola, video artist pioneer, free exhibit of his work is opening on September 26th. And there's going to be a lot of cool events tied into that as well that we'll be talking about in the future here on Art of the Matter. But that's going to be a great exhibit as well. And also to put on your calendar
for the
visual arts, well, iMocha is going to be opening up their new Cityway location on October 3rd. And that's going to be their second location, including their Fountain Square space and then also at Cityway where the Alexander is. And that's going to be very cool, too. Some cool things coming up in the visual arts.
Fabulous. Hey, over at Butler University, there's a faculty recital coming up on Tuesday, October 7th, not too far away, at 7:30 in the Idson Duckwall Recital Hall. It's a free concert featuring double bass performer as well as faculty member David Murray with pianist Kathy Bringerud and soprano Lorna McDonald. Music by Botticini, by Richard Strauss, and as they say, many more. That's on Tuesday, October 7th at 7:30 at Butler University.
Very cool. And last thing I have, Sharon, the Poets Laureate of Lawrence are doing their monthly featured poet open mic series that happens on that fourth Tuesday of every month at the Lawrence Arts Center on Indy's East Side on Franklin Road from 6:30 to 8:30. And this month they are featuring on September 23rd, poet Fran Quinn, author of The Goblet Crying for Wine and A Horse of Blue Ink. And so that is coming up on Tuesday at 6:30 at the Lawrence Arts Center. Sharon, we can learn a lot more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
Sounds great. And we'll see you next week with more events on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
There's nothing like being able to talk with the artist who created some beautiful work of art while you're looking at it. Well, the 2014 Architects Home Tour offers you the chance to see how these design professionals have solved problems for homeowners, as Sharon Gamble learned from Brian Birch. Brian is a working architect and also the chair of this year's tour.
Brian, how'd you get yourself involved with the Architects Home Tour?
Well, I was actually on the committee for the 2012 tour as well, and I work for a residential architecture firm, so I've been very aware of the tour for quite some time.
Sure. And this tour's been going on for a number of years, right? 8 years?
Yes.
Something like that?
I'm not actually sure the time frame. It's every other year. I know I've personally only been on two of the tours.
Yeah, but that's because you're young.
Yeah.
You didn't know when you were five you
exactly.
wanted to be an architect.
I was not aware
right?
of the tour.
So what is the guiding principle of this? Why do an architect's home tour?
Well, I think it's really an opportunity for the public to experience a home designed by an architect. I think maybe people are or are not aware of the fact that a lot of homes might not necessarily be designed by architects or be directly, or the clients might not directly work with an architect. So it gives people the opportunity to see what a home designed by an architect actually looks and feels like.
So describe where the homes come from that aren't designed individually by an architect.
Well, I think a lot of times, you know, most of us are familiar with a lot of more suburban development that we've seen as of late. So a lot of stock homes, you know, going online and potentially buying a plan off the internet.
So an architect was involved at the get-go with kind of a general outline,
right.
But from there they become customized by the developer?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Okay.
So, I mean, a lot of times, you know, the client won't ever work directly with an architect and won't necessarily get a custom home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is kind of a unique opportunity for them to see a home where the client worked directly with the architect from day one, and then also the architects are often at the home, so they get the opportunity to actually meet the designer and hear a little bit more and understand more about that experience.
Now, when you thought, I'm interested in architecture, I want to go to architecture school, were you thinking about residential architecture? Were you thinking, I'd love the chance to help people figure out what their dream home looks like and then help them articulate the parts and help them get to that dream home?
Yes and no. I think everyone, when they grow up, since you inevitably live in a house And if you're interested in architecture, I think you automatically think about houses.
Sure.
Everybody kind of sketches floor plans out. So I think, yes, I was interested in residential, but I didn't really know the extent until going through the educational process. I think residential architecture is a little bit different. Kind of what you touched on is you're very directly connected with the client. It's very personal for them. So there's a lot more personal investment on their end that goes into the project than, say, there would be in a hospital or a larger scale commercial project.
In part because they live there 24/7, even if they get up and get in their car and go to work in the morning, but that's their home.
Exactly.
It's kind of sacred.
Yeah, it's very close to them, yeah.
So it strikes me that you might need some skills that I don't know if they're provided to you in architect training or not, but I mean, you kind of have to be a psychologist. You kind of have to be, hold people's hand in some way. You have to educate them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, you never know. I mean, there's obviously every client is different and there's different personalities. And a lot of times you do have to negotiate those personalities, even sometimes internal conflicts with clients themselves. Exactly. So I think you don't necessarily realize what you're getting into at the get-go, but yeah, there's certainly, you know, a lot of benefit to having a skill like that.
Are most of the homeowners present during the tour so that tour guests can talk to the homeowners?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's cool. Let's talk about the houses, because if people are hearing architects home tour, they're figuring practicing architects have probably designed these fairly recently. And that's true of some of the homes, but some of them, we're looking at additions or,
sure,
or changes, yeah, to the home.
So
right?
The majority of the homes on this tour actually are new construction, but there are a couple. There's one in Butler Tarkington that's a renovation and addition. And then there's also another one in Glendale that's also a renovation addition. So there is at least a bit of combination between new and old and reworking and new construction.
So the Butler Tarkington one, tell us about the style and about what the homeowners wanted,
sure,
realizing that these weren't your clients personally.
Sure,
but,
right,
yeah,
right. So that one was a Tudor-style home, 1930s, and the clients partially wanted an addition on it, so they wanted extra square footage. But also, I think a lot of times what you find in renovations of old homes is they want to be able to live, you know, our modern lifestyle in that home. So they want the home to be more open, more connected spaces, more open living spaces, and maybe more connected to the outdoors as well. So that home, a lot of it really was looking at how do you reorganize the spaces to allow it for more of a connected open floor plan.
Hmm.
So you'll see there the kitchen is completely open to the dining and living spaces. It's much more connected, and you get a lot of interesting new. You also get a lot of interesting moments where you see the new and the old, which I think is nice. So people will walk through that house and they'll feel the older portions of the home, and then they'll know when they're in the new portions as well.
Fun.
Yeah.
Those transitions must have been fun to design,
mm-hmm,
and fun to live with too. And the house in the Glendale area, is that a 50s or 60s house?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a sort of prototypical ranch from that era. And so that one was much more of a kind of minimal part of a master plan approach, where the clients knew they wanted to do a series of renovations, but they couldn't afford to do it all at once.
Okay.
So I think that's a great example of architects having the ability to come in and do small-scale interventions in a home. So that one is a brand-new entry and a second floor. So there's a small second-floor portion which houses two bedrooms or a bedroom and an office, and then a new entry into the house.
So that architect worked with these homeowners to phase in the different improvements.
Now with that house in particular, you know, there'll be future projects that are planned that may or may not completely involve the architect.
Sure.
But the architect certainly was a part of the master planning.
That's so interesting. Does that happen very often where people, you know, come and say, well, I only have X dollars right now, but my grand scheme,
sure,
by the time my kids are grown in 10 years or whatever,
mm-hmm,
that,
yeah,
happens?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of times clients, you know, they come to you and they have this grand vision of what they want. and you can help spell it out how to get there, and they may realize through that process that that might not be step one. You know, that might be step three.
Yeah.
So what can we do in the meantime to renovate to get towards that step?
Sure.
But still get you closer to where you ultimately want to be.
That makes such sense. It's kind of like phasing in a landscape design where you're like, if you really want your mature trees, you better plant those this year.
Yeah, right. Because we don't want to come in and do this tiny little addition, and then 3 years later you go, oh, well.
That didn't quite
that
do
didn't
it.
Fit
yeah.
with where we want to go with the overall plan.
Of the newer construction houses, tell me about some of your favorite features.
Sure, sure. So I think there's a lot of interesting elements to some of the new ones. I think something that I always like with architecture in general is how the site informs the design. You know, so architects have to be problem solvers. We have to look at the site that we're given. We have to figure out how to make all of the program and the client's desires fit with this site that we're given. So one of them in particular, colleague at my office, Demerly Architects, designed a home in Broad Ripple that it's actually situated in a floodplain on the canal.
Not ideal.
No, not ideal at all. So I think the lot actually, this lot in particular, had never had a house on it. And I think partially the floodplain, at least in recent times, was a big reason for that. So I think that one's really interesting because you get to see how the architect approaches the problem of the floodplain and resolves it not in the typical way of, I don't know, you might
picture
just
stilts. Putting the house on stilts.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think the end result really is interesting because then you get to experience spaces that you're used to, but you experience them in a slightly different way. So you're in a living room that's slightly elevated above ground, which gives you a different perspective on your surroundings. Like, for example, that house is sited directly on the canal. So when you're in those living spaces, you get these views out that you might not otherwise have had if you didn't have that floodplain restriction.
Wow.
So I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then one other one that I think is really interesting is the one, there's a house in Chatham Arch that was designed by 110 Studio. And that one is a fairly small infill lot. What's that mean?
Infill. What's infill?
A lot, typically an urban condition that's situated between two existing lots or two existing homes. So, which again, a lot of times when you're working in the city, those are the kind of lots you end up dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lot more influence from your surroundings, I would say, than in a lot of other instances.
Mm-hmm.
So this one in particular, the house basically, due to the client's desires, the house and the program ended up filling basically the entire lot. So they were left with basically no backyard.
Hmm.
So I think that house is really cool because when you go through it, they create a courtyard space that the house wraps around.
Oh.
So that becomes their outdoor space. And it's different than most people are used to in terms of what a backyard is.
It's a center yard,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. But I think it becomes the focal point of the house, and it becomes the point that everything is organized around.
Wow.
And it has a plunge pool in it.
What's a plunge pool?
Oh, basically, it's this tiny little pool that's deep, and the thought for the client in particular was that he would go on these runs, come in the courtyard and basically plunge right into the pool to cool off after a run.
Love it.
And it also becomes like the water feature.
Yeah.
From when you're in the house, you look out and you see this.
So smart.
Yeah.
Other than having the pleasurable experience of looking at how other people live, what do you hope people do after they come on this home tour?
Well, I hope, number one, I think with this tour, there's a couple things. So this tour, we have homes in seven different neighborhoods in the city. So I think it's a great opportunity not only to sell the value of architects and design, but also to sell the value of the neighborhoods. So I'd love for people to walk away from this and go, wow, you know, there's a lot of great things about that neighborhood. And, oh, there's also a lot of great things about what designers can bring to a project. So they may, you know, I think a lot of times people write off an architect for better or worse because of, you know, various stereotypes or preconceived notions of what that might mean. But I hope people at least walk away and go, oh, wow, there's a lot of value in considering things from maybe a slightly different perspective.
Sharon Gamble with architect Brian Birch, chair of the 2014 Architects Home Tour. The tour is this Saturday and Sunday, September 20th and 21st, and you can learn more and get your ticket at architectshometour.eventbrite.com. Again, Architects Home Tour on Eventbrite. And while you're there, you can look for the special package deal for the Architects Home Tour and Broad Ripple Home Tour tickets. Again, it's all at Architects Home Tour. That's all one word. You can search for that on eventbrite.com. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out what the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra is up to this season.
I'll chat with the IMA's curator of audience experiences and performances, Scott Stuhlin.
There will be no cats or cat videos.
You never know.
And I'll chat with Rad Drew about his new exhibit at Clues Hall. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.